Abel's opinion was, not that I'm paying off God, but that I give the sacrifice as an act of recognition that everything belongs to God. Why do I give him of the best of what I have? To show him that I recognize that it's not mine. And my symbolic acknowledgement of God's adnus, of his lordship, is by giving him of what I have. What is the difference now between Cain and Abel? After the sacrifice, according to Cain, who has absolute title to the world? Cain. According to Abel? God. So Cain, therefore, Abel, Cain is a pagan, it's sacrilege. Abel is a genuine religious gesture. Similarly, if any Jew comes to the synagogue or comes to Jewish observance with the idea that he's doing God a favor, now obgedavend, obgegeben, obgelern, now I'm on my own, it's a pagan in Jewish form. But when you come with the acknowledgement that my giving is merely indicative of everything else in my life being devoted to God, then that is genuinely religious. Well, so then we face the policy question, what's going to happen if this becomes a real issue? Ought we to strive for restoration of Karbanis, Karban Pesach, or not? Of course, there are just too many objections. Politically, there is the claim, although unjustified, that we are violating Muslim holy places. Culturally, our own cultural and aesthetic prejudices are overwhelming at the present time. Communally, renewing the sacrificial order may very well split the Jewish community even more than it is. I can just see my Reform neighbors who officiate at intermarriages with non-Jews going to Jerusalem to offer up a carbon. The Orthodox community itself is not by any means unanimous on the halakhic issues. And Israel's religious community is simply too politicized at the present moment to allow it to do this job properly. And yet I confess, and call me a primitive if you want, I confess that introspection into my own heart and old soul tell me that when I have these hesitations, it's because I'm a coward. Because I am a coward. Because I am irrevocably a goliseed. I'm an exile Jew. The resumption of Karbanis in our day would be nothing less than an act of chutzpah. You know what chutzpah is, it's untranslatable. And American Jews, unfortunately, have no chutzpah. We're cowards. When the Israelis in the bitter days of May and June were rushing to battle with joy and with confidence, we were shivering in our boots. And bechlal, in general, the Israelis are remarkably self-sufficient and overabundant in chutzpah. Sometimes it's a little negative. Sometimes. All the time. But thank God for that chutzpah. You and I and our children are alive, and if we'll be safe in Yetz Hashem, it's because the Sabra has chutzpah. Because of that chutzpah, he won himself a state. And even if it's sometimes annoying, that chutzpah helped do the job in 6 days. The Talmud tells us, Be'ikvasa de'meshichasa chutzpah yazgei. In the days right before Mashiach, there will be great chutzpah in the world. And Rav Kook used to pay special emphasis on this chutzpah. And he said it's a remarkable thing. There will be chutzpah that will be anti-divine, and there will be a chutzpah that will be wonderful and blessed. And without the chutzpah we see, the Messianic era could never be brought on in our times. It requires of us a natural, national, spiritual boldness. And who knows? Who knows but that a concerted Israeli chutzpahdike effort may not show up the vacuousness and the shallowness of our political and cultural fears that I mentioned. And remarkably, that a Karban Pesach may, in its sheer romanticism and its unusualness, suddenly act as a cohesive force by centralizing the worship of Israel once again, which was the original purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, just like the Kosel Ma'arovi did 6 months ago. In exile, for a second thing, we have always stressed the rationalist dimensions of faith. We have always tried, when I speak to my congregation or to my classes, I always try to explain to them how reasonable Judaism is. After all, it makes sense. Is that a worthy endeavor? Yes, but within limits. Because there comes a time when if it is overdone, we fail to appreciate the Kedusha in Judaism. I remember this is a true story. I had a Jew in Springfield, Mass, a lovely young fellow, was a little distant from Judaism. And I began to bring him close, and one year, I actually convinced him to have Bedikas Chametz, the search for the Chametz. And I had given a long talk about how the search for the Chametz is symbolic of the Yetzer Hara. We get rid of the Yetzer Hara, of the evil inclination. About two or three years later, I say to him, whatever your name is, Sam, I hope you did the Bedikas Chametz last night. This is Erev Pesach. He said, no, Rabbi, I didn't. I said, why not? He smiles shyly and says, no problem with the Yetzer Hara. He meant it. He really, genuinely, sincerely meant it. You see, there is a great danger in having a religion sound too reasonable, because then we become the determinants of what's going on. The rationalist makes a mistake because he emasculates Judaism if he overdoes it. You see, Judaism to be real means that you've got to stand before God with a tremor, with a feeling that you're confronting the unknown, the majestic, what Rudolf Otto, the great theologian, called the numinous. There's a sense of mystery that I never can probe. And if I think I can reach and understand all of God's mind, I'm a darn fool, as well as being arrogant. Religion has an absolute minimum of the non-rational, of the mysterious, of the secret, of the obscure, of the hidden, of the awareness that I'm only dimly conscious of great worlds that I can never apprehend. We must have that if we're going to have a genuine religious experience. We have had enough of the rationalizations. They're good, they attract Jews. But after you attract them, you've got to make them genuine religious Jews. And to be genuinely religious, you must have a sense of mystery, a sense of the hidden, a sense of God's glory that is unavailable to my understanding. The sacrificial system, by its very denial of my modernist cultural prejudice and temperament, may be the very element that will add the sense of Kedusha and the sense of the numinous. And finally, last week we spoke of the fact that this period in Jewish history is a period when we are emerging from Hester Panim, from God's hiding of the face. It's a period of the dream of Yored Hashem Panav, when God and Israel begin to draw close. The ancient reason for the sacrifice, according to the rabbis, was that the word korban, kuf resh beis nun, comes from what word? Karov, which means close. In offering the sacrifice for mysterious reasons, the Jew felt that he was coming into the realm of the divine. He didn't feel that, all this terrible blood and the odor and the guts. No. But for some reason that we cannot understand, he was transformed into a feeling of the presence of the Shekhinah, a feeling of Nesias Panim, a feeling of Karov, of closeness. We have absolutely no assurance that that cannot occur again when the Institute of the Sacrifices is reinstituted, is reorganized and rebuilt, whenever it may be. V'yosu li mikdash v'shachanti besocham. Let them build me a temple, and I will dwell not in it, says God, but besocham, in them, in the Jews who come to it. To summarize, therefore, what we said this evening, we discussed the halachic issues in the current controversy of entering the Temple Mount, the Har HaBayis, the historical importance of the Har HaBayis. We discussed the opinions of the sages of Israel, the four opinions about rebuilding the temple in our days. We spoke about the significance of a Beis HaMikdash in evaluating the two poles of the holiness of place and time, Kedushas HaMakom and Kedushas HaZman. We spoke of the question of the restoration of the Korban Pesach in our days, its historical and its halachic dimensions. We tried to give some hasbara, some insights into the spiritual importance of the sacrificial order, both liturgically in our prayers and practically. And finally, we spoke of the advisability of such restoration if it could be practical. To conclude, I think you can by this time appreciate my initial hesitation and apprehension in undertaking this lecture. I don't know if I've succeeded in convincing you. I pray that at least I've succeeded in informing you. We live in a marvelous age when surprises are commonplace. And if when we open the New York Times in the morning, we're not shocked by something unexpected, then we are shocked that things are the same as yesterday. Technologically, politically, culturally, religiously, there's always something new happening. In the last 10 years, we Jews, as well as we Americans and we humans, have seen a remarkable movement, remarkable change in all of life, from fashions of women's dresses to the psychology of the adolescent, from military technology to scientific theory. Well then, friends, don't sell the Rabbonu Shel Olam short. We stand at the threshold of a great and a wondrous age. We are, as I said in the last lecture, in the middle of a dream. And who knows what is yet to come? We are at the threshold of the age of Nesias Ponim, when God and Israel are on speaking terms again. We've only begun to see his face, and there's a great deal we have to listen to if we have the humility and the chutzpah to do so. Only a fool will claim the knowledge for certain of what is yet to come. The rest of us will say with simplicity of faith and with grandeur of hope what we say after every Shemona Esrei. May it be thy will, our God, and the God of our fathers. That the temple be rebuilt in our days. More important, let us not be carried away only by romantic dreams, but we must have our portion in the Torah, study and practice. And when the temple is rebuilt in our Jerusalem, v'sham na'avodcha, there we will serve thee in the ancient service, kimei olam, as the days of yore, u'cheshonim kamonios, and as in those glorious years gone by.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Lamb, for treating a most difficult and important topic in a delightful, informative, and thought-provoking manner.